thank you all so much for coming. I just wanted to say this is a particularly sad day for our students, for us and our students, as we're coming to terms with the loss of one of our technicians over the weekend. So you have to kind of forgive the low turnout of students today. I'd just like to introduce our panel this evening. Hiroki Yamamoto, Fiona O'Rourke, who's joining us on Skype from Ireland, Stuart Wilding from the university, and Dominic Thomas, a Stroud-based artist. So Hiroki graduated in social science at, you have to forgive me now, University in Tokyo,
yeah.
And completed his MA in Fine Art at Chelsea College of Art, London. He's a postgraduate student researcher at the University of the Arts Research Centre for Transnational Art, Identity and Nation. His PhD research is about socially engaged art in East Asia. His practice-based research explores what insights collaborative and participatory art projects generate in an attempt to address and tackle the post-colonial issues in East Asia. Fiona O'Rourke comes from a visual art background and is currently in the final stages of a PhD in education at Goldsmiths, University of London. Her research critically analyses how race is socially reproduced every day in education institutions in ways that often appear neutral or invisible, and the various ways these processes of racialization can be disrupted. Fiona's race-related research concerns have emerged from her experiences working as an art teacher in education institutions in diverse geopolitical contexts, including United Arab Emirates, Oman, Spain, Ireland, and England over a 15-year period. She's worked in the Department of Educational Studies, Goldsmiths, and has contributed to a number of programs, including the MA in Education, Language, Culture, and Identity. Stuart Wilding is a senior lecturer in Art and Design Theory at the University of Gloucestershire, with a particular interest in the politics of representation, the structures of feeling, and in how things sound. He's also an improvising percussionist, the coordinator of Cheltenham Improvisers Orchestra, and a contemporary music curator at Exposed Club here at the University of Gloucestershire. Dominic Thomas has been a cultural producer, educator, and arts and community coordinator for over 15 years. He has initiated and coordinated arts and environmental projects and events, both locally and internationally. His cross-disciplinary practice has involved performance, photography, video, installation, sound, critical writing, web design. There's nothing you haven't done, is there, Donna? Publication, horticulture, and cookery. Much of his work is collaborative, and he has a particular interest in self-organisation and self-education with an artist-led and community activity. He was the programme development worker at Stroud Valley's Art Space, SVA, with whom he has worked for the past 7 years. He's coordinated many exhibitions and events in collaboration with SVA and other arts organisations, and worked with artists and groups in the UK, Croatia, Spain and Sweden. He is the founding member of the collective A Group, which I'm also involved with, initiator of Reproject Space, and is a co-director of Creative Sustainability, CIC. He recently initiated the Fungus Loci Urban Mushroom Project and curated the Mycoculture exhibition in Stroud. And finally to Richard Hazel, the exhibiting artist at Hardwick Gallery. Richard Lazell is a London-based artist who works in installation, video, and performance internationally. He pioneered a series of innovative artist residencies in industry, defining the role of the visionaire. He's the author of Enhanced Performance, and there's a copy of Enhanced Performance over in the corner on the table, and Green Pages, and is an artist researcher with ResSen at Middlesex University. Rich's practice explores the divisions and boundaries between media, materials, and contexts. He has designed and led a number of socially engaged projects worldwide, where the relationship to audience and community has been fundamental. In a square mile in Shanghai, Richard lived and worked in one square mile of South Shanghai for 2 months, researching the evolution of this defined area. Here he formed relationships with cleaners, taxi drivers, students, bird fanciers, kite flyers, Tai Chi practitioners, shoppers, and retired people, and the series of interventions that followed these encounters included performances, installations, and collaborative events. Sorry, that was a very long introduction, but I feel is probably necessary. I just wanted to start actually where that biography kind of leaves off, because I've known your practice for around 10 to 15 years, and you often worked previously, your work's taken the form of collaboration, either with the audience as kind of active or maybe unwilling or implicated participants, or with named collaborators or invented characters. And as I was reading Enhanced Performance before the discussion, there was quite a nice word where it says that your work often embraces the audience. So really, I guess the first question, as kind of chair, I'm not going to take too much part in this, but I was just wondering how you see this exhibition project, or indeed your residency in China that took place in 2008, where there, and perhaps here as well, we are cast in the role of spectator, rather than, I guess, you know, we talked about those sort of active collaborations that you engage with when you were over there. But how has that worked for you being in that role of spectator?
So, do you mean in a way, how does this exhibition sit with my...
I guess that's what I'm saying.
With my practice.
Yeah. And also for us as... where do you think it sort of sits for us as well as audience members?
There's always a long story behind a single question, really. So I guess, you know, part of the reason for me to want to show here was a little bit about your history with Meantime, and knowing that there was an interesting, I guess, process coming from you. And then when I made this proposal, I wasn't sure where the work would go. I guess it was, you know, 9 months ago or something like that. But I knew that I was in this place of wanting to deal with this, it wasn't really an issue, but a situation that I found myself in with the death of a student who, I guess I was close to her because she was Chinese, and my experience of China was so intense, particularly in the Square Mile, where I was with a lot of young people who were about her age and I gradually understood the significance of the one child rule, that this just went through society like a seam almost. So the young people I was meeting were all single children, and within their families they were kind of cherished as you would. If you can only have one child, then you'll cherish that child in a special way. You couldn't help it. So they're all slightly, I don't really like the word spoiled because it doesn't really mean anything, but they were sort of, they were very confident, a lot of them, and the world was new. China's changed so fast. So that was one of the main themes that I came back with, that you know, China gets a lot of bad press in the UK, almost unanimously it gets bad press, and I was living a kind of strange but normal life with the people, where I didn't really see Westerners most days. I just was with Chinese people, and even if I couldn't speak the language, if I was in that society, which wasn't a tourist place at all. And it became deeper as the time went on, and to the point where I didn't really want to come back. I wasn't ready to come back to England. So when Mavis, who was a very much a star student, she was straddling these worlds of East and West so brilliantly, I mean, extraordinarily well. And I understood some of that you, as a young Chinese person coming to study in London, you either withdraw or you express, and she was, you network, and she was definitely on that spectrum. So that was the beginning of this. I felt like, as I wrote in, I don't think I want to read out what I wrote, but that was sort of very much the story of where it came from, that I responded to her parents and her funeral, and I felt like I wanted to say something about my feelings about China through. And I had done that through performance, I guess, in relation to the Square Mile. But this was different. Mm-hmm. This had led me to this Willow Pattern theme, mm-hmm. and then questioning how China had been seen for so long in the UK and Europe, mm-hmm. and is still seen, I'm sure, with much many filters. Mm-hmm. That we can't help but have, and some of those are racist filters, there's no question about it. Mm. Some of them may be political, but some of them are definitely racist. We have to acknowledge that's around, I think, when you look at any culture. So to put that, to go back to your question, you know, to put that into an installation, a work, was... it wasn't collaborative in the same way, except I did occasionally have an imaginary conversation with Mavis about it. And I still have a fictitious collaborator who I wrote to occasionally. We communicate by writing, and she had an opinion here and there. Mm-hmm. She's changed her name now. She's not called Tanya Kozovich anymore. She's called Peru, which is unfortunately the name of the new coffee that Starbucks had just launched, but that's completely different. So Peru had a view, and it was strange, you know, and slightly, it felt slightly transgressive to talk to Mavis, and also not. Mm. I would just write the odd thing, and she would say, go just do that, that's fine, or something, or, yeah, the top hat, that'll do. Bring the top hat in. I like that picture, me wearing the top hat.
I did wonder, actually, as I was writing this, whether or not there was an element of collaborating with Mavis in this, as it's been such a sort of strong part of your kind of recent practice.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe we could bring Fiona in here. Fiona, can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear perfectly. Great, okay, thanks.
Good. Fiona's particularly interested in the willow pattern aspect of the work. So perhaps you want...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd like to begin by discussing the Willow Pattern exhibit. I actually got a lot out of that piece. I thought it was really interesting. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give a very brief reading or analysis of this piece, if that's okay, and then follow it with some questions. I'm particularly interested with how the Willow piece, Willow Pattern piece works on a subversive level in the gallery space to counter negative race ideologies and preconceptions about Chinese peoples, which have been socially produced in Britain. So in this exhibit, the artist takes an object from English culture, Willow Pattern porcelain plate, which is commonly perceived to be Chinese, and reveals that it is an English invention based on designs derived from China. And this exhibit also calls the viewer's attention to the Willow Pattern legend, which was written by British subjects in the mid-19th century imperial era, and encodes racialized ideologies about Chinese peoples. For instance, some of those racialized ideologies encoded within the Willow Pattern legend story attribute negative racialized characteristics to Chinese people, such as greed, bribery, corruption, murderous ruthlessness, etc. So this exhibit then rewrites the legend of the Willow Pattern legend in ways that critique these implicit prejudices, and physically then this exhibit then physically deconstructs this object by breaking it up into different pieces. So I feel this exhibit works on a subversive level in the gallery space in contemporary England by calling the viewer's attention to the racialized ideologies encoded within this Willow Pattern image, which has been produced in the British imperial era, and then by deconstructing it on a discursive level and also on a physical level by literally taking it apart. I also feel that this exhibit works on a subversive level in the way it has a clear relationship between the artist, the artwork, and the imperial history from which it has emerged. For instance, the artist has taken this object from English culture, which was originally produced presumably by white British males in the 19th century imperial era. And he, as a white English male in contemporary England, is deconstructing and critiquing the race ideologies it encodes, exposing how they've been socially constructed, kind of excavating that imperial history. And then in some ways, I think by doing that, it redresses these past injustices on some sort of level, subversive level in the contemporary era. So my question is, what is the relationship between this Willow Pattern exhibit and the racialized ideologies and imperial history it draws the viewer's attention to and the other pieces in the exhibition? For instance, how are the other pieces in the exhibition positioned within this imperial history? How do they operate within and against it? How do they work to subvert racialized ideologies or preconceptions about Chinese people in the present? I know that's a lot of questions.
Is that for me? Do you want me to answer?
Yeah, sorry, Richard. I haven't even met you face to right. face. I'm bombarding you with these pretty heavy questions straight on. That's but okay. I feel these, and I tell you, I'm currently writing, I'm finishing a PhD study that explores some of these, many of these racialized ideologies. And in fact, some of the research I've done has taken the imperial curriculum, right? It explores racialized ideologies in the imperial curriculum that was taught in British education institutions in the early 20th century era. And some of the ideologies encoded within the Willow Pattern legend are actually in some ways similar to those encoded within the imperial curriculum. So this work has in some ways, some links to what I'm currently researching.
Well, I really appreciated your response to that, my Willow Pattern investigations. Thank you very much for that. I think your question's really very specific about how the rest of the exhibition, whether I see the same kind of critique happening. And I suppose you know, as I've said in the introduction, I see every kind of making of a work as a journey, and this journey, some of it was quite intuitive. So there was something about that photograph of the woodpile in the recycling centre that was part of my square mile, and the video of the men throwing the plastic pieces up onto the lorry, that I found, you know, visually arresting. And then the sort of meaning part gradually evolved for me in that I wanted to sort of celebrate recycling in China. It's almost another tourist joke, is that you take photographs of the people, men and women, who cycle these tricycles that are weighed down with material stuff, because they're literally cycling to places like in my square mile where they get paid money for the recycling. And yet, you know, whether money's involved or not, the way recycling happens in China is just completely breathtaking. And at the same time, we're shipping loads of our garbage to China to leave them to deal with it. I mean, it just struck me as completely absurd. And I guess I wanted to celebrate what I saw as an understanding of materiality, of materials, certainly in Shanghai. That's what I experienced. So I literally wanted to try and recreate the woodpile in a gallery, and it was just to see how that would look. It was no more than that. But it was also about knowing that within that photograph, there was more to the story in that photograph, that if you look really hard, that material, that pile of wood, is being weighed and sold by weight. So there's this cluster of people looking slightly anxiously about how much is it going to weigh and what will they get for this. And these are very poor people. This is part of their income. So there was that element too. And then, there was the video clip and the photograph of that I wanted to, I just thought would be interesting to bring in. And the third element, which is along the folding wall, came about partly because of the nature of the space in the Hardwick Gallery, is that the more I thought about it and planned it, I thought there's this very large wall that folds, which we can't fix anything to, so what else could happen with that wall? And that led me to thinking about making a kind of mini installation that would have some of the writing that I've been doing about tea. So I haven't talked about tea. So tea, for me, was also part of my research into Chinese culture, the way that we use tea and the way that Chinese people traditionally and currently use tea is just a world apart. Tea drinking is incredibly refined. It's a hugely revered and delicate process. And that might be changing at the moment with the invasion of bubble teas with young people in China. But still, I saw many people in China holding glass beakers, which I never knew what was in them. Certainly wasn't coffee. It was sort of, maybe it would be some seeds or some berries. So there's a different relationship to tea and drinking, which I wanted to sort of flesh out. And that happens in quite a subtle way in that central piece, and that's why there's a physical tea there, which is a clue to tea. And I've written some pieces based on a very famous piece of poetry about the beauties of tea drinking. So those are the sort of themes which are less obvious than the Willard Patton story, but I feel that they're all there in a way to explore our kind of, not necessarily prejudice, but our presumption, our preconceptions about Chinese culture and Chinese society.
Can
can I just say also that it's you're free to comment and take part in the discussion. Everyone's it's an open.
Sorry, may I return to the question a bit? Let me ask in a different culture. First of all, one thing I must confess is I am neither Chinese nor a specialist of China. So if you have any question about China, ask Richard. And the question I had when I saw your proposal, it's what you thought or felt about your own experience in China. Because from my own experience of living in the UK for years, I think the process of living in a different culture, language, and space is somehow the process of unlearning. Unlearning rather than learning. I mean, accumulating new information or experiencing new knowledge or something like that. And the process of unlearning created some kind of blank space in myself to accept other cultures or different concepts, if not understanding it. So I just want to ask you about your own experience. What did you feel about your own experience, and what kind of influence, not only for your own art, but also yourself in a broader way?
I thought you explained that very well. I think it was similar for me, that I guess the idea of the square mile was not my idea. It came from an organization that set up this residency, and other people were in other square miles in other cities. So there was a Chinese artist in Walthamstow in London, which is a strange area to be placed. Another one was put in Bradford. There was a British artist in Dhaka and a British artist in Delhi. So the concept of the square mile, we all have worked with it in our own way. But for me, it became almost all-consuming, because I had this boundary, I had my map, and the more that happened, and the more people I met, and the more things I tried, the more I wanted to stay there. So I rarely left the square mile. Yeah. And I would meet other Westerners, and they would say things that I was shocked by about their experience of China, that they didn't want to engage with certain things. They didn't want to eat the food, or they criticized things a lot. And I developed a strong friendship with my translator, who was a very she's just like a typical educated Chinese person, is that she had a sort of lot of practical knowledge and a history of not being a wealthy person. So she gave me particular insights, and I would just ask questions and be absorbing. And so I think it was a bit like unlearning. It was almost like being a child, is that everything. I didn't want to make presumptions about anything.
I feel somehow the process of forgetting what I have taken for granted for a long year, and reinterrogating that kind of presumption, I think.
Something that I've been thinking as you were both talking about this sense of how you feel when you experience a new place and get immersed in this new culture that's kind of different from your culture. And I think there was something I read that Trinh Thi Minh Ha talks about, never feeling at home. You begin then to, everywhere becomes strange and different, and you take that on as a way of experiencing everywhere you end up, which I think is very similar to this idea of a kind of, unlearning and kind of being open again and not having those kind of ways of thinking that you've kind of grown up with and are familiar with, and your kind of thoughts change.
Thank you.
because I was just also thinking about this representation of China that we get, and your idea of the one person child is very common here, and we get that. And yet my experience of China is that for the children, that's not really such an issue because they have cousins and they have friends, and there's a different kind of family. So it's just different from us rather than a kind of, you know, something we should feel more about, if you see what I'm saying. It's kind of, it's the way it's experienced is important.
What I think is interesting about what we've sort of touched on so far is this, there's a thing, obviously, you know, talking about the willow pattern and the tea and that kind of, you know, the history of the connections, these global connections, which actually go, you know, way back to the Industrial Revolution and before, even, you know, between the UK and China in particular, but, you know, lots of other places in the world. There's actually been a very long history of, you know, of trade and exchange, you know, which has taken various forms, in, you know, including the, you know, the sort of imperialist form that obviously Britain was long involved in. I'm kind of beginning to wonder whether that's actually turning around now in terms of our relationship to China, possibly. But the thing I was kind of interested in, there's this, you know, clearly this long and very deep history that we have of connection. And yet when it comes to our kind of individual kind of understanding of these cultures, we seem, you know, completely at a loss, you know, as if we're going to, you know, we've only just discovered this place, you know, it's, mm-hmm. there's only, you know, on an individual level, I've not been to China, but even, you know, going to places in Europe and things, you come across places that you feel you don't understand on an individual level. And yeah, you have to go through this kind of unlearning process. But I'm kind of, you know, I'm just, I think, I suppose I'm saying, what is it? Why is that? Why why do we not understand each other when there's this long history of activity? Mm. Is it because, I don't know, what is it? What is it now? What's going on?
Can I jump in?
Please do.
I'm at the edge of my seat here, I'm dying to hop in. I would argue that it is in part as a consequence of our Eurocentric national curriculum, which does not acknowledge these interconnections and interrelationships between cultures like it should. Of course, if our young students, you know, our young children and young people were taught about this very long history that has occurred, you know, not only between China, but also diasporic populations over a period of like several hundred years. But yet this history, these interconnections between diverse race and ethnic groups is rarely acknowledged. And if it is explored, it's usually on a very superficial level. I mean, there's this huge amount of research about this, but within the context of this exhibition, I think, you know, it's so critical, because I think this is one of the key issues at play here, I feel. This history that we're speaking about, this very long history that dates back, you know, several hundred years, and the complexities involved in exploring that history within a contemporary gallery space, and all of the contentious issues that it often, you know, raises.
I think
Richard I'm guessing wants to respond to all of this at this stage.
No, I was just saying, I'm jumping in, Fiona, because I think that is the issue. It's the complexity of knowing the other that makes it so almost so impossible to actually experience. And for me, the overriding thing, seeing Richard's performance lecture and then comparing that to the exhibition, I felt like I was seeing a very different side of China in terms of what was represented. I mean, when I go into the exhibition, I'm not drawn to things, and I do see your point about subversive element of the Willow Pattern, and the other work I saw as kind of, I imagined what it would be if you were Chinese, what would you feel about the poverty that was on show here, the fact that people are struggling around to try and find a lump of wood so they can get a cup of tea.
I'm not sure that they're struggling around to get a lump of wood to get a cup of tea. I mean, it seems to me to be quite a major trading base, and a good one too, actually. In the same sense, other people trade other commodities rather than desperately being this and that to gain a cup of tea. Mm. I'm not saying there aren't people doing that.
But that kind of, you know, what I see in the gallery is very different from how Richard talked about his kind of love and excitement and the wonder of the kind of experience that China offered. And I think I just see two very different things in those two events, if you like. You know, when we go into the gallery, I see this high-end fashion bags at one side, which is again a very much a feeling we see here as a stereotypical view of China. Oh, it is now super wealthy, it's becoming the most powerful economic power in the world, it's, you know, it's challenging everybody, and this is something we should deplore because, you know, now they've got all the wealth and we haven't, and all the young people there are, you know, desperate for designer clothes and are kind of engaging in this consumption that we've kind of suffered. And then I see also these piles of rubbish which are, you know, people are collecting to live. Not just, you know, I was being facetious perhaps about saying to make a cup of tea, but I think cup of tea is also an aesthetic experience, but it's also taxi drivers are drinking tea because it's so bloody hot and they're working all day, driving all day. And so I think that it's kind of getting a sense of what's going on in a place. It's kind of really complex. And I was just very, you know, I was very taken with your talk, Richard, and very kind of, and you know, I have been to China. My experience of it was very much the same, hearing those sounds and being with people, like you said, the sense of humour and the fun that Chinese people have is, you know, it's just really interesting to see these two kind of extremes, if you like, set out by your work. So I haven't got a question. I'm just responding to what people have said. But,
do you want to respond or should we?
Or
I think we could open
it
up.
Fiona suggests, I think, suggests that from the Western point of view, European point of view, we're socialised in the 20th century, socialised to have a particular view, and that's the result of it is what we're discussing. But I wonder whether any of that work has looked at why the people who are perpetrating that view, education and the people in control of things, wish to have that view, wish to perpetrate that view about China. What's going on underneath there? Actually, Stuart, you said we didn't know much, and it struck me when you said that. It's because we're not told much.
Maintains power relations, doesn't it? I mean, that's
that's right. Yes. So
what's underneath that control?
Do you want to come back in there, Fiona?
Oh yes, of course. It serves raised political and ideological purposes. I mean, I know that there's. I know I've read some material on just going back to the Willow Pattern. I know that. Legend, for instance, served raised political ideological purposes during the imperial era because it maintained and reproduced an image of Chinese populations as inferior to supposedly an inferior, Anglo-Saxon race. So there were obviously clear problematics. Highly racialized problematics with those fictitious ideologies. And in the current era, in the contemporary era, as the speaker to my right, I'm at a disadvantage because I can't see people that I'm speaking with, but it maintains and reproduces these power inequities in our society.
maintains.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, that's it, it maintains.
Yes, that's right.
It's key. And that's one of the questions there, isn't it? I mean, who's interested? I mean, I'm surprised that you say this of the current time, contemporary time, when things are much more open. But just back 50 years, the education about other places in the world was very, as we're describing it. My conclusion might be, thinking about it, that the people who held power, which would be traders, the conservative classes, politicians, these people in the 20th century and earlier, realized that they kept their position through having the other and the various kind of meanings that go within all of that. And the other half of us in the rest of the land don't have the opportunity to be socialized in a broad way, or didn't then anyway. Yeah. But unbelievably, when I was at school, in a grammar school in the late 1960s, I was told that people who lived in the West Indies, as it was then, were very happy and kind of basically worked in a banana production industry, loading boats, and they were stevedores, they were called. Actually, they were, we know what was going on, right? Half the area was in war. Nobody ever said anything about this in the 1960s in the grammar school. So that's what I kind of see in this.
And I think that, just talking, it's very interesting, the historical connections that Fiona's talking about, but just the power now, right now, the English language is just unbelievable across the world. It's just staggering. I've just been in Ethiopia and things are written in English increasingly.
There's also what happens the other way, because when, I've experienced Chinese students coming, trying to work with them, and they're immediately infantilized by the fact that they can't speak English, and because it's such a different construction from their own language. So the effort that has to be made, same for you, all the time, it's exhausting, and we would have that experience if we did it the other way around, wouldn't we? But we don't do that, so we're in this slightly different position. We, unless we put ourselves, like you did, in that position, we don't, because everyone speaks English, we're not disempowered very often in that kind of way, by being so reduced in our communication that we become childlike.
Mm. I wonder if the language issue is not actually connected to the cultural roots. We're talking about China and Europe and so on, but much more so to the rise of computing and American use of English across the internet and in computing.
Yeah,
so everybody's required really to speak English.
I'm sure it is, but nevertheless it's happened.
Yeah.
We're not all really learning Japanese or Mandarin, are we?
No, that's
we're
definitely
not really.
Unfortunately for me.
If we're German, we're going to speak English, because
but increasingly, sorry to interrupt. increasingly, though, students parents, there's been a good number of documentaries about this in recent years. Parents have been sending their children to learn Mandarin, have they not, in England in recent years?
Mm. Particularly the well-to-do, if their children
yes, that's
going
right.
to finance, then they're studying Chinese at university and going to study. Mm. China, so because they recognise the economic power.
Yes, that's right, because China is now an emerging superpower.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting, that relationship, other than, I've had experience of kind of Italians in England wanting to keep their children speaking Italian and learning Italian about Italian culture, to hold on to a past and a kind of tradition that they kind of feel that their children are losing. By being immersed in English culture, but this is this idea that actually it's a way forward to actually be skilled at Mandarin and be skilled at English, so that therefore you can make advantage of both,
yes.
Which is a very different sense of that kind of idea of thinking about tradition and how important that might be.
Can we go back? Oh, to Hiroki, did you want to say something?
May I just interrogate one presumption we I think we naturally have taken for granted. When we say China, what exactly does it mean? Because there are not only two languages in China, for example, not only Mandarin and Cantonese, because there are so many, I think more than 100 small languages are spoken by minority people, and some of them has long been suppressed in Chinese by Chinese government. So I think this is strongly related to what you said,
no,
like complex understanding others. When we, for example, through art, representing some different cultures, I think there are always something that falls into oblivion, be it intentionally or unintentionally.
Yeah, things get lumped in, you know, the whole, you know, Yinchuan is so different from Shanghai, and that the whole idea of Africa, and like, well, what's that? You know, you have to talk about the countries that are there just to start, then let alone the tribes and the races that are inhabiting in that particular space.
So this is a difficulty of representing different culture, and I think this is one of the things you try to talk in your installation, that is what I heard.
Yes. But it's also interesting that as a culture here, we do get a particular stereotypical dominant version of what China is. So there is a kind of collective imagination about the other, which has a lot of power. And that's the thing that any representation is either supporting and maintaining or attempting to critique and break down. And it's an ongoing kind of struggle between, you know, that movement between.
You could say it the other way around, though. If people think of Great Britain, they think of London.
Sure, absolutely.
They think of the different dialects and histories and the different countries like Scotland and Ireland and Wales.
Yeah, becomes a dominant image of here. Sure. I mean, those that use the stereotypes as a way of just understanding the complexity of somewhere.
Yeah.
And sure, we need them. I mean, it'd be impossible to understand every minutiae of everything. You know, I always think about the library, going into the library, you'd have to have a separate shelf for every book, a separate Dewey number for every book. It's just not possible. We have to kind of lump things together somehow.
Isn't there a difference between sort of an overwhelming amount of knowledge and that's available that we have to find our way through, and an actual kind of moulding of what the consensus view is by others within the culture? Like,
those power things still implicated.
Two different sort of strands a bit there.
I think the problem is that kind of monoculturalism is not acknowledged, is it? We talk about this kind of vast geographic area as one.
We don't realise we're talking about it as in that way, and it's not like that.
It's not really, I guess, in our language, in the way that we talk, we don't acknowledge diversity when we talk about China, I guess.
And that's an interesting kind of correlation in terms of your residency there, which is absolutely limited to one square mile in terms of, and obviously, as you've sort of described, getting to know that, but you didn't have enough. There was not enough time to get to grips with just one square mile of a huge country like that.
I think that was something that I wanted to say about the role of the artist in all of this, is that there are some very serious themes in this piece, and then one of them is talking about death, which isn't something that's comfortable to do, really. And another one was Orientalism and the kind of prejudice we're talking about. But I think something that, in a way, relates to your work, Dominic, is about what happens when we as creative, whatever, we don't really like that word, but we as kind of creative beings develop sensitivities Isn't that kind of what the role of the artist is about? So we are highly sensitized in some ways that maybe someone who's working in the stock market hasn't got the space for, isn't interested in. So as sort of cultural sensors, I think artists are incredibly valuable, or sensors to all kinds of aspects of life, really. So your mushroom knowledge is, you know, on a spectrum, and my knowledge of a square mile in Shanghai is on a spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't disagree with your point there. But just to, one thing I was going to say to sort of play devil's advocate a bit is, is there something that needs to be acknowledged in terms of, thinking of the role of the artist, in particular the role of us from the UK as artists going to other countries. Can it be said that we are, part of a new cultural imperialism, in fact, that's going on in terms of, contemporary art, contemporary art as a cultural manifestation in the global scheme of things has its own sort of imperialism built in, I think, as well, in terms of the way it's kind of the way it's produced and sold and traded. And I think, I think it has to be acknowledged to a certain extent that being, an artist in residence in a foreign country, we are playing, even, however subversive we kind of want to be, we're playing a small part in what's can be viewed as a sort of imperialistic motivation. Would you say, Richard?
Yes, I think there is an element of that. I worked against it as hard as I could.
I'm sure you did.
But there is an element of that. And there was an organisation in Shanghai called Public Art. And they said to me, Richard, we need help with this. There's not enough of it happening here. Tell us how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I was very thrown, and they didn't really understand what I was doing. But nevertheless, I could see that they just genuinely want to adopt many of the strategies we have.
Is that about, China, basically? Because as far as I'm aware, what China's doing is developing itself as a one-party free market system. It's developing this whole notion of effectively a sort of capitalist dictatorship, that's growing out of the communist one. And that kind of need to adopt the capitalist free market accoutrements, which includes contemporary art, is part of that.
Which includes the critique of the dominant economic culture. It's part of what art does, isn't it? That's the bit where you can play, where you're allowed to, explore and to critique. But you can't. You start trying to get in on the power is when you have the problems.
Except to balance that there's a huge cultural thing going on with Chinese art being bought in the West, isn't there? I was involved in it.
Which I think is the same part of that same legitimizing of capital. Yeah. That's how you could argue. That's what's
it is. An exchange. Yeah.
It's both ways. It's trafficked both ways.
Although it's arguably it's just global now. It's a global art market, and Chinese are going to get in on that in terms of production.
They have though the last 15, 20 years. Yes, sure. They've been very quick to pick that one up, and Chinese galleries. There's places in London which have, they're huge collectors, aren't there, of Chinese art?
Does that say other ideologies worry me more, though, the way advertising might be encouraging young women to have nose jobs and to lighten their skin? Mm. This is the frightening thing about Western culture, that power to subvert ideas of,
Does the fact that it's a two-way thing, as you say,
Yes.
Does that relieve the imperialist actions of us doing this?
Well, except well, Richard did say that...
I think this, it's an, you know, contemporary imperialism is a global imperialism.
So,
in my pocket imperialism. I have a piece of plastic that says HSBC on it, you know. And that's, you know, it's... Yeah, it's not nationally focused.
But also, Richard did say that Chinese artists in this program came to work in London. There was a kind of crossover, wasn't there?
There was, but I think Dominic's making this good point. I think.
Thanks, Richard.
There is. It is happening. Mm-hmm. This kind of imperialism does continue. I think of course, China's extraordinarily complex politically. And who knows where it's going to go? Who knows? But I think the thing that really impressed me was how quickly they can flip it back onto us. Mm. And to some extent, Mavis represented that. She was playing both worlds seamlessly. Mm. And so I don't think that it's going to become politically different radically for a while yet.
When you say flip it both sides, so do you mean that the Chinese people are more skilled at playing and moving in different ways to a different environment?
I think some
than we are.
Some of
they're
the
more
new
flexible, the younger people.
Some of the new generation are perfectly comfortable living in China in seemingly a dictatorship and relating to the West. They don't see it as a problem. They know that if you step in a certain direction, that's not acceptable and you'll end up in prison. But within that, they don't seem to be restricted.
Is that because they're, if I could say they, but you know, they're socialised not to critique their system?
Yes, I think so.
And so, as an artist, and going back to that point that Stuart made, as you know, like implicit within our artistic practice is critique of our systems. Does that, when they were talking to you, the people in the public art place, was it the socially engaged practices that they were interested in developing?
Mm-hmm.
So where does critique sit within that? Because, you know, socially engaged practices,
I think they know where the line is all the time.
Right.
They just know. Mm. And some critique is okay. I think, you know, my experience of doing some intimate, like I said in my performance lecture, where I stood still in a subway for a half an hour without moving, that would not have been acceptable in London. I would have been stopped immediately. The fact that, okay, it's not a strongly political act, but nevertheless it's a bit subversive. So, and Chinese people knew that would be okay. Oh, well, that would, that you're not doing anything. Mm. So, it's their culture. They kind of read it. Mm. Like every culture reads itself in a highly sensitized way that would take us, as you were saying, a long time to be able to read in the same way. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine you living in London took you 2 years before you could fully read certain things. I mean, reading metaphorical.
More than 2 years.
More than 2 years. Yeah. And I'm not talking about language, but, you know, science.
Not only language. Actually, language is really problematic because the syntax itself is totally different, totally opposite between Japanese or Chinese and English, some kind of Latin language. But not only linguistic terms, but also culture, society, and I think.
There was something that Hiroki and I were talking about on the way here, where we were talking about the impossibility of representation.
I just want to raise one kind of contested theme about in relation to the impossibility or difficulty to represent other cultures. There is a tradition, a traditional culture in China called Tensoku. Tensoku is, it is difficult to translate, but if I was supposed to translate it, it is kind of foot binding or compressed foot. There was a culture in China to bind the foot, female foot, especially when they were child, because in the traditional concept of beauty in China, smaller foot are more beautiful, something like that. And it makes the female really difficult even to walk, or they couldn't run at all. And so I think it is one of the reasons why kind of male-dominated society has been retained in China for a long time. So when I think about some kind of contested cultures, what should we do? Or is it possible to like to say this is one of the culture of other culture? So what do you think about it? Because I sometimes feel that kind of difficulty when I go to China, even if I understand this is a part of, for me, it's an important culture in China, but there are some cultures, or not only in China, but also some African countries as well, that not, in a sense, neglect in terms of ethics or justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your question is, what?
My question is, I think it is very important for us to open, or to try to understand other cultures. I think when we face some cultures that, in terms of our ethics, that cannot forgive, what should we do?
What should we do?
Yeah, because one of the difficulties for them, it is, of course, even though it is kind of, for example, ridiculous or painful culture, the culture, it is also culture for them, and there are some reasons that that kind of culture has long retained. So.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the problem.
Because you could say that it would be an imperialist act to order them, you know, to critique, or to assume that we know better.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, our sensibility and our ethics are totally challenged.
Yeah.
It's a dichotomy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to push our ethics or justice to other culture?
Mm.
One ethical viewpoint is, an intervention or not is what is the outcome of doing this or not doing that in the individual case.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some cases it may be appropriate, it may be judged appropriate, depending, even if it's appropriate, it may not be appropriate to do it because the outcome is poor for the, whoever's concerned. So it's another angle on the ethics of that choice.
Yeah.
But that's also in the decision of the of the other isn't it? The you know the outcome could be very different according to where your position is. So you know if you have a lotus foot, if you're a foot bound woman who's not now but historically, you might actually have think that this was the best situation for yourself because you're so immersed in the culture.
Then that's part of the balance of the outcome.
That's part
isn't
of
it?
The outcome. Yes.
Yes.
I think this is one of the problems in cultural relativism or relativism generally.
Mm. How about, though, actually, I think one of the things that the exhibition brought up for me was, I guess as an audience member, I don't actually feel that I have a negative view of China, and I guess for me, I had some questions around when I read that, who was being addressed in that, because, you know, I feel in a way quite sensitive to, and I'm just, you know, I'm just kind of talking sort of fairly subjectively. And I guess for me, it seemed it's almost impossible to represent another culture without raising these questions. And I kind of wondered if that was almost the point of the exhibition. I guess in a way it wasn't, because you had your own kind of personal reasons. But I guess when those images are put out into a public space, into an exhibition context, then all of these historical, you know, these inescapable historical references are loaded on top of it. And for me, looking around at those works, I felt that you were kind of almost, you know, damned, and you know, whichever way, because you know, as a white male in you know, attempting to represent another culture with all of those kind of complex power relations, no matter what your intentions are for that project.
You
have all of these other things kind of
it would have been much easier not to have dealt with the subject matter, you're quite right. Yeah, much easier.
Well, but that kind of relates to my observation as well, which is about the performance, because I think the performance was, you know, it engaged with that in a different way.
But I think also what it represented was impossibility.
Mm.
There was a number of kind of staged references, you know, those kind of 4 points, and each of them seemed as impossible as the other, which I think is something that you possibly didn't even intend. Well, it certainly wasn't maybe not your motivation, but I don't know, how do you feel about that?
Well, I accepted that.
Mm.
I was trying to do something that was kind of impossible,
mm.
even down to when I got the willow pattern fragments
mm.
from my friend's garden that she'd gardened for years, and there were all these bits of willow pattern that then you couldn't help but feel affectionate towards the willow pattern in terms of it's in everybody's garden, and it's so embedded in English culture in a kind of gentle way. So there was a paradox there, but I think my kind of rage about the willow pattern, my increasing rage, must have come through to Fiona.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, I'm not the first person who's unpicked this legend at all. Mm. I mean, that's taken from other people's research. But smashing the plates was cathartic.
Mm.
It was cathartic, and there was some revenge in that, and some justice about my own upbringing around lack of knowledge of what. Just the fact that China is the same word as China. I mean, come on, you know.
Mm.
I have a lot of anger about this, and so. That probably didn't come through in the performance, because I tend to want to make people feel good
mm-hmm.
when I'm performing. And in the installation, it was I was able to let it be more awkward and maybe less resolved in a way. So, you know, in that sense, it was fantastic to have that opportunity to make a work that is a bit awkward.
Mm. Yeah, certainly.
Mm. Can I just ask, were some of the devices you used more intuitive?
Yes.
Because with the whole, you know, the thing we're talking about is very much about the idea of the concept, but there were some decisions that I thought you made, particularly against the screen, where you had the work about tea, that I thought must have been to do with a kind of experience of objects in space.
Definitely.
Like the wood, putting the wood in black tea, and then the angled black things that, you know, didn't seem to have an immediate relationship, although I see the tea does now, but they seem to be something that was to do with creating visual meaning, a kind of visual intelligence, a visual understanding in the space, separating things, using materials to separate and position, you know, which worked with the ideas, but also had their own, you know, we also had, coming from a different kind of an aesthetic or an understanding of the medium that you've chosen to work in, which is art. You know, do you see what I mean? It's
absolutely.
You know, however conceptual, there's always this aspect of the art and how it actually plays out in the space.
And they're there.
That's
kind of what I meant more about the performance, because that's gone.
Mm.
And it wasn't just affirmative, it was actually critical within that affirming and kind of fun, you know, that you said you met. But I think, for me, the difference with the exhibition is that work is still there, and that the images are still in that space.
Mm.
So you know,
you mean
and they're so loaded.
Yes.
Because those images come along with the history, they can't escape that history. The artist can't escape that history. The viewers who view it are inscribed within a history. We've been, whether we like it or not, we carry it around us. It's like our baggage.
No, sure. I was thinking about the Benetton, the Toscani image of the breastfeeding woman, who, you know, just her torso with the white baby. I mean, that kind of, you know, used as an advertising motif, but brings up all that history of slavery and the colonial past, you know, in that one.
That's right.
Mm.
Yeah, does anyone else
want to
have any
it is somehow related to that topic. I think, what do you think, what did you think about your positionality when you started a project in China? Because there are no transparent écriture, that kind of things, because it is totally different for me and for you to do the same thing, even the same thing. Because, for example, I'm Japanese, and as you may know, Japan colonized some part of China, Korea, Taiwan, and some part of Indonesia. And so I fully understand some kind of arrogance when I, as a Japanese, try to tackle East Asian post-colonial issue that Japan actually created.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about your personality as a British to start some project in China or in a country?
Yeah, it was very complicated.
Mm.
But I didn't see that I was going to be frozen by the opportunity. So one of the things that I did that I probably talked about in the performance was that I held some signs up written in characters that were saying things that a Westerner wouldn't normally say. And so that was a way of reaching out to people who could read. Not everybody could read the characters. And I was interested to try and be other than how I looked is all I can say. But you know, I was condemned all the time. And I'd go to a shop and buy some tape, and they would say, "Are you the boss?" Through the bottom. And I would laugh and say, I was from an organisation who had an account with them, but, you know, I'm not the boss. So, you know why they thought I was the boss. You know why. And I couldn't get away from that, really.
Who wrote the characters? Who gave you the...
Oh, those characters I worked on with my translator. And she suggested one that I would never have thought of, which made that the best of all. Because I was coming up with things like, I wish I could speak Chinese. And that was sort of misinterpreted. People say, would you like me to teach you Chinese? Which wasn't what I was saying. I was saying, I wish I could speak Chinese like you're expected to speak English. But the characters that she suggested were two characters, which was old foreigner, which is a term of affection for foreigners. And she knew that Shanghai people would recognize that as an in-joke. And that was the one that got the most response and the one that I felt closest to, because I was totally sending up myself as an older white man and also as a foreigner, but also I was in the know of what those characters meant. So, you know, you experiment and you poke around and you find something. That's how I see it, really.
It's a very interesting strategy, though, because, you know, you can imagine that being pinned on your back by a local to tease you.
Yeah,
you know, and then you brought it to the front and showed it. So it's a very interesting strategy.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sarah, I lost you.
Something you see as
I guess, you know, currently the imagery that we have around us is all around trade and selling and buying. And I don't know that they're, you know, in the national discourse, I'm not sure that those are seen as negative things. I think, you know, we're always seeing on our politicians going on trade missions to China, and but yeah, they do come at that expense, don't they, of other forms of communication, and you know, that's where the emphasis lies. Mm.
I think there are some shifts going on with Asia around cultural influence coming the other way now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will get bigger. There was the big Korean hit, wasn't there, that went to number one.
Oh, yeah.
Sign.
Mm.
And that's
okay.
I would say that's the beginning of I think Japanese fashion is having an influence now. I think, yeah, on a popular culture level, there'll be more and more coming the other way, I suspect.
Mm.
I think, in terms of the art market, I think it's still going to be very strong in the West for a long time. That's how it seems.
Mm.
So, you know, it's strange here.
But does our capacity for exchange, is this kind of what you're saying? Does it just rest within trade? I guess that's what...
No, I mean, that was for me what was so memorable about my experience there, is that I felt that I had a real exchange that went beyond politeness because of the kind of life I was living.
Mm.
And yeah, I think I learnt an awful lot from many people that I met, and that's there for all of us all the time.
Mm.
But we have to drop some things to be able to do that. We have to drop some shyness or some preconceptions or some comfort.
Yeah, I was just thinking, isn't it? I mean, I think there's something to be said about that, you know, the individual, you know, making that personal connection with other places. However kind of insignificant and feeble that looks when we, you know, compare it to a kind of global system which is, you know, clearly powered by money and trade and stuff. I was watching a film a little while ago called Manufactured Landscapes. I don't know if anyone's come across that. It's principally about a photographer, a US photographer who makes these big images of post-industrial landscapes and stuff. It was a sort of documentary about him, but it was also about him taking photographs. A lot of it was about China, but in other places as well. A lot of this film depicted some of these huge factories in China that are basically producing a lot of the kind of electronics and other stuff that basically run our lives here in the West, generally. And I was really kind of struck by just seeing, and it was just, you know, big static shots of massive factories, rows of young Chinese people assembling products on an assembly line. And there was one shot of this woman putting together, and it was a, It was something you'd buy out of B&Q, you know, it was like a plug socket or something, you know. And I was kind of struck with thinking, if we could actually acknowledge those things that are part of this global kind of trade thing, actually acknowledge the kind of personal within this, that then maybe we can actually make some kind of connection through, you know, the simple, you know, this plastic cup, you know, all the people who put together this plastic cup for me today, you know. And I don't know, I was just watching this film, I was thinking, I don't know, is there, you know, without having to go to these places, we can say, well, actually, our lives are completely connected and completely intertwined in our modern and dependent, in our modern, comfy Western lives. Mm. And what we really should be doing is kind of acknowledging that more. But, you know, we are dependent on the other so much.
I'm not sure people will understand the people behind these artifacts until they understand perhaps more about the artifact itself. In the West here, I suspect that people in the East, if you like to put it that way, understand a great deal more about materials, just naturally, or than we, than my culture does. And so I'm saying that's a bit of a vain hope when nobody was involved in the manufacture of that cup, actually. Apart from the people who designed the tooling, the rest of it is completely automatic.
Probably.
So this is what I mean.
We're very the cup is not a very complicated thing.
No, but
it doesn't involve a lot of assembly. It's true.
It's not very complicated, but actually it is deeply complex.
And
so that's what I mean. We're so detached from the... just from the materiality of the things that we use in the non-art world, the ordinary world, in other words, that the prospect, as I said, the prospect of understanding anything about where it's come from and who with and all the rest of it is, I think, somewhere in the future.
Well, that's what I also really like about that photograph in your pile of wood, particularly in your exhibition, Richard, was that, you know, it did kind of seem to convey a sort of understanding of material that was there. I mean, there was obviously a monetary exchange going on and stuff, but there was a kind of, in that process, there was an understanding that, you know, this was part of, you know, there was the material, it was part of the process, the people who collected that wood could make use of it in terms of getting money for it, but it seemed to convey that maybe more of an understanding of the materiality of the world and the processes that are involved than maybe we appear to have here, you know, by going to the, you know, picking our stuff off the shelves in B&Q or Tesco's or whatever.
Those photographs do kind of illustrate that in a sense, because although there's money passing hands and there's that commodification, I guess that the people collecting the wood and trading the wood all actually are treating the material as what it is, as opposed to even what its commodification value is, but it's actually, well, this piece of wood, so it inherently has some value to somebody somewhere, as opposed to being sort of debris. And that's what I'm saying we don't recognise here in the West. But actually, as a general, obviously, I think a lot of people may not realise that.
Sorry, what? What do you mean when you say a capacity or ability to exchange? Is it the ability to make relationship with others or something like that? I want to ask.
Jess.
Ability to exchange?
Well, I guess I kind of paraphrased what you said. Sort of
Politicians seem to see China as a sort of cheap trend, I suppose it changes how Chinese people see us, similar to how Richard was saying he was asked if he was the head of the company.
I see. So because of my I'm poor at hearing English, so could you rephrase?
I guess Jazz is saying have our politicians kind of in reducing our relationship to China as being one of trading. Has that
I think one thing that also that you were talking about was that the idea that, that we see China as a source of cheap labour. I mean, they export their own people. I mean, they're no more innocent than any other kind of, you know, huge economic power.
I see.
You know, all part of that sort of anonymous mass production, which, you know, sort of fuels, maintains, you know, shifting balances of power globally, which you know doesn't sort of necessitate any real engagement with you know, with culture, with anyone's culture. It's all about that.
Okay.
I think you're also asking how do Chinese people view us?
I see.
You know, if we see them as being the kind of cheap labour of the world, then how do they?
As far as I know, I try to answer do my best. I think as many sociologists said, relationship itself has been commodified. Relationship is one of the commodities. This is a factor, I think. However, the biggest reason I feel some kind of discontent with Althusser, Louis Althusser, and like Foucault, is that while Althusser assume some kind of big brother, some kind of authority that try to control ourselves, Foucault didn't, because power is us, I think. So the question why the ability of exchange, like, or ability of understanding others, ability of try to comprehend other culture has been reduced, we should rephrase the question as why we eager to reject others, because there are some reasons, for example, the fear of others or kind of precariousness in the contemporary art world, not only art, but also in a broader sense. So I don't know about, I have no knowledge about politics, but I think what we can do is try to finding out some element within us to want to, in a sense, reject other cultures or something like that. So that is what I feel.
So it's back to the kind of the position of the individual, the sort of personal ethical position, which then goes back to the artist as a kind of cultural instigator or cultural practitioner.
Yeah.
kind of interesting, when I was in China, David Cameron paid a visit to Shanghai and Beijing, and he was, it was very much appreciated by most Chinese people that I was in contact with, or the kind of sense that you got from the news that it was a very welcome event, and especially because he was, not him obviously, but his team were tweeting in Chinese, they were in, you know, local languages, and his message was being understood and welcomed.
What was his message?
Usual politician's message. You know, that, you know, we're all friends and we should help each other, as you can imagine. But it is the complex. This is, of course, you're talking about different generations as well. You know, knowing kind of older people would still have value in some of Mao's ideas because it was what they were brought up with, and they seemed to help them, and they felt better off, and they felt under less stress. Now, under new systems of free markets, they feel under increasing pressure. And this idea of people putting commodities together in a factory where they've got, you know, the highest number of suicides in that factory because of the pressure of the work. And then all the company does to relieve that pressure is to build a trampoline around the outside of the building for when they jump off. I mean, there's some crazy uses of kind of economies and kind of understandings of those kind of, you know, people's lives. It's incredibly complex. And yet, and there's other, you know, my friend's cousin is very committed to an escape to the West because of the fear of Japan. You know, that it's so close and this could happen again, and I need to get away from China. Where could I go? The West would be safer. You know, so there's kind of lots of, you know, already these complexities of their own relationships to other cultures.
But do you think, I mean, I'm not as knowledgeable about it as a country as you are, but don't you think that China has a understanding of its power as an economic power, which is growing all the time, its potential in the future is far greater than the West?
Sure.
There's a confidence there. It might not have percolated through.
Mm. No, I think a lot of the people feel that too. You know, they see that, and they, you know, you've got to see the new buildings going up every week. And,
Shanghai.
But then there are internal disputes over, you know, like planning permission and rights and, you know, everything that goes with the building trade in terms of bribery and corruption. And
and what's happened recently with Hong Kong and the protests, which was, you know, didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, the dominance of China in Hong Kong. I mean, to me, that speaks volumes about how it's going to play out in the future.
Sure. It's continuing pressure, HSBC. Continuing.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any final observations or questions or comments to make? Because I think it's probably a good time to draw the discussion to a close.
Yeah,
thank you very much to our panel, Richard,
Dorothy,
Stuart, and Dominic, and Fiona in the middle.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona.
Thank you.
We enjoyed.